They could create tremendous number of jobs, all of which now comes out of what Reaganites like to call the public trough. Put it over here. Supposing it is government-owned, and I think it should be. That's personal opinion. But it would be returning something twice over of what we put into it in time. And it's there. It's once it's in place, it's a national asset against which you could eliminate the national debt. It would probably cost the total amount of our present national debt to do it, huh? I don't know. But look at it, wouldn't cost the economy that much. Because every time you put a worker to work, you eliminate all these other things, and that money goes back in, he's going to pay his share of the taxes. Labor's going to have to get involved in those type of things. Because it is a way out of what we're doing. We used to laugh at the Russians right after World War I, and they had their revolution. And they used to have their continuous five-year programs. And we used to kind of laugh at them. We put out plays like Nanachka and others, which kind of kidded at the Russians. They spent most of their money in what they called their national industries. Steel, railroads, oil, a lot of things. They did a pretty poor job of it in a lot of cases. But look what they have now. After these many years, the Russian economy is probably one of the soundest in the world. They don't have a huge debt because their debt isn't measured in dollars versus these other things. No, their debt's out of the production. If they take people and workers and material, which is all owned by the state, and put it in it and build a plant, they've increased their asset. And whether or not a socialistic type of economy is going to be the thing we end up with, I don't think it will be. I think it'll be some kind of a halfway point, perhaps. Because they have some things that are inadequate in their system. Perhaps just as important as ours are. But all I'm saying is that they have gone from almost nothing into a nation, a great world power. And here we have gone from a great world power and are getting ourselves deeper and deeper in a morass. And it isn't just the United States. It's the so-called whole free world's economy is in this shape. Now, something has to be wrong when we go from a great productive power into a declining productive power simply because we're not able to continue extracting that tremendous amount of profit out of the thing and plowing it back in like they do in other countries. What should Japan, what Japan was after the Second World War, what it is now? And they don't have socialism in Japan. They have sort of a controlled, a guided economy, substantially different than ours, and maybe we would or wouldn't want. And I don't know how to, I would never preach for a particular kind because I don't know that much, except that I know there's things that you do. Now that's the kind of thing that unions will have to get involved in. And all of that's quite a long ways away from Long Beach, Brooklyn.
Oh, but it's still interesting.
Well.
What happened after the 1948? Like, how did the union change or stay the same? Or?
Well, after 48. First of all, we took a licking in 48 insofar as this district was concerned. As I indicated to you, at the start of that strike, we had about 22,000 members in the union. I became the director almost a year later, in December of 49, a year. So the strike had been over about a year for most of the groups, for about 10 months for the union oil group. And the first year I became director, when we started to count heads, how many people were actually paying dues, in our district. We had about 10,000 it actually, and they begin to cut to keep the records cleared out and everything like that, it was down below 9,000 people were actually paying dues, in not just in this local, that was throughout the district. Now this was due to the fact that a lot of our people, we didn't have union shop contracts. You know what a union shop contract is?
Yeah.
Okay. Except in very rare cases. Our contracts
had... Did you have them in 1948?
We didn't have them before. We had maintenance of memberships. Now, first there's three kinds of union security. One is a closed shop. The closed shop says that if you work, you got to belong to the union, but you got to belong to the union to get a job. He posted a union contract. They put union workers there first. If they run out of union workers in that area, then somebody else can apply and become a member of the union and go to work. So the union said it was a source of hiring, as well as having the person have to belong to the union when he's there. That became illegal. Excuse me. That became illegal during the Taft-Hartley law. After Taft-Hartley. A closed shop was illegal. A union shop is where you don't have to belong to the union to get a job, but once you've been there for a period of time, then you have to join the union. And you have to just maintain your membership in the union during the period of that contract. A maintenance of membership is that you don't have to be a member of the union to get a job. You don't have to join the union, but if you do join the union, you're entering into a contract with that union to continue your membership in that union for the duration of the contract. And at the end of the contract, then a new contract is signed, and if you are a member at the time the contract is signed, then you have to stay in again. But the companies usually insisted on having a period of time in which a person could exercise the right to withdraw. Very few of them did, but some did. Well, these are the kind of contracts we had. After the 4-H strike, a number of them exercised their right to withdraw. And so we went from having, by far, the great majority of all of the workers in the union that were covered by the contract. We went down to, in some cases, where we might have even had 50% or less. In some of those cases where the companies thought we had less, they challenged us, they filed a petition, the same as the union would, and asked to have a new election held. And we won all of those elections except one. We always maintained our bargaining rights, but we didn't get our membership back for quite a period of time. So what happened after strike out here? We went down to about that 10, a little below 9,000 members. I called all of the leadership together into a meeting, told them that we had to do something to reinstill in our membership, first of all, the fact that we were the union for oil workers, that we were here, we were going to stay, and we were going to advance, grow. So we put on we call the California Organizing Caravan. We took leaders took their vacations, staff were all assigned, the people we had on international payroll, local unions who had full-time people, some of them went. And we went all over every location in the state, contracts, we handled the plant, we had meetings, we got get-togethers and whatever, you know. Some of the locals put on breakfast for us, and it was pretty good demonstration of this fact. In some areas, we actually made house calls, talked to people who'd been members of the union, got them to come back. Some of them, we put dues inspection lines up at the plants and asked people to show their dues cards as they went through, and those who really had always believed in the union but got out because their wife had insisted or whatever, embarrassed some of them to the extent they came back. But we'd gradually begin to get a little of initiative again. And instead of constantly facing decertifications, we actually went out and started doing some organizing. So we gradually begin to come back, but the most members we've had since that time is about 16,000. Now that isn't all due to the fact that we never gave them all back. Part of that is the plants. These 85 contracts used to have excuse me. I'm going to sneeze. These 85 contracts used to cover, excuse me, used to cover about 23 or 24,000 people. Those same 85 contracts today probably only have 16,000 people doing the same work. In other words, there's been a substantial reduction in the number of people that work in those plants. Maybe not even that many. Probably be less than that because the number of people employed has almost been cut in half. Nationally, following that strike, Jack Knight, that was in, as I say, in 52. We went through a period of growing up until 1955. We had gotten our own union up to the place where national we had about 90,000 members. Now those were people who had joined the union who had never taken any action to get out. Some of them would be maybe a month or two behind in their dues. But they had never, you know, they never notified anybody. There might be a few that had died that we didn't know about, or this type of thing. So that probably out of that 90,000, there was probably about 85,000 that were actually every month paying their dues. We probably averaged about that. There was a lot of growth. I mean, we'd had some good substantial growth. We had organized some people. We had made several attempts during that same period of time to merge with other organizations in the oil industry or oil chemical industry. Our first effort was to try to get a large number of independent unions who were outgrowths of company unions and had stayed company unions until the board began to disenfranchise them because they were company dominated. And then they formed made little changes and became independent, so to speak. There were a large number of them, especially in the mid-continent and on the East Coast and in the Deep South, that had never been organized by a legitimate international union. They were organized in plant by the companies and helping to form the organizations, had at one time been totally captive organizations. They'd gotten somewhat more independent. Some of them were quite aggressive and some of them fairly successful in their own little narrow operations. So there had been some growth. We went into a program of trying to bring all of those people into one union. We recognized that many of them had pride just like we did, and although we were substantially the large union, and they all kind of waited until we did something before they, you know, they never settled a contract until we had settled. We kind of rode our shirt tails. They had some pride in their own leadership, and some of them had historic reasons for whatever they were. I don't try to justify them. They had what they thought were historic reasons not to trust our union because we were CIO and there has been some words about CIO and this type of thing. And I'm sure they, in that they were encouraged by the companies. But by their growing as an independent, we thought we could encourage them to join with us and would form this new union, totally new union. So in 1952, we had a meeting of a convention in Philadelphia, which we went with these unions, and they were probably, our union with its roughly 90,000 people that we represented, the independent unions who probably had another 50 to 60,000 represented. That may be a little strong, but not much. We sat down in this meeting at Philadelphia and we wrote a new constitution. Most of it was ours, but there wasn't much quarrel. We had to give up a point here or there, and they basically took our constitution, but we formed a new name. We called it the Oil and Chemical Workers. And then we, after we had adopted that by all of the people present, then they were to go back to their groups and get their groups to affiliate with this new group. And we were to do the same. In other words, vote to leave our union and join this one. And we left it open as to whether we would affiliate with the AF, with the CIO, which was the union we were affiliated with. We fully intended to later, but then we were willing not to forego that, not make that decision at that time. We went back, and immediately our union had a special committee. We adopted it. We endorsed it, the idea. We said we'd join it. And then the president of the union had the job of going out and trying to have our people involved in selling us. It became my job to, I was given the job as a sort of a special rep to go out and meet with these various independent unions around the country, encouraging them to vote affiliation. So I spent probably the most abortive 5 to 6 months of my total union experience. I traveled all over the United States, mostly east of the Rockies and in the south, but I all over the country, meeting with these various independent groups, trying to encourage them to take to a vote this question and to join. And I found out that there was all kinds of problems, most of which demonstrated the caliber of leadership that they had in those independent unions. For example, I went to Whiting, Indiana. Now, we had a large local at Hammond, which had a membership of about 4,500 people. Good local. The secretary treasurer of that local up there knew a number of the people that worked for the Standard Oil Company at Whiting, Indiana. Standard of Indiana, thank you. I couldn't. Yeah, I said Indiana, did I? Yeah, the old Red Crown, Standard Indiana. But anyway, they were one of a group of about 5 refineries that Standard of Indiana had. They had a refinery at Whiting, they had one at Sugar Creek, they had one at Wood River. They had one in a little town in Kansas, and one in Texas City. The one in Texas City was the only one that was OCOW. The rest of them were just independent. When I met with this group at Whiting, it was a 5-man board. That was who we were meeting with. And our first meeting that we'd had with him, this guy named Dave Herring was the secretary of that local, I was telling you about. He was working with me locally there. He'd set up the meetings. And the first meeting we held was just nothing happened. And so the next time I came in town and I'd ask him to set up a meeting, he met me at the airport and he asked me what my plans were, and I said, well, we're going to stop off and we're going to buy about a half a case of booze. And when we get to this particular meeting, you be sure you don't drink much because I'm not going to drink much, but we're going to see that they do. I'm going to find out what's bothering those people. And we did. The liquor flowed very fast. And Dave and I were drinking iced tea because it looks a lot like bourbon. But finally, I kept getting these hints from these people. Finally, I asked them, I said, well, what are you talking about? What will it take to have you guys take a vote to come into our union? Or come into this new union? And the guy says, well, you know, we've been offered some money if we could bring our group into other unions. And I said, well, that sounds reasonable. It's a big group you've got down there. They had about 6,000 employees in that plant at that time. That sounds reasonable. What are you talking about, you know? Well, he says, well, we're talking 5 figures. Well, I said, well, 5 figures. Now, that takes us from $10,000 to $99,999. I said, that's quite a spread. Can you put a figure on it? And finally they came out and they were talking in terms of $50,000. And I said, well, you know, if we had an organizing campaign in your plant, we'd probably spend a couple $100,000. $50,000? You talking $50,000 a piece, or are you talking about just $50,000 for the group of you? All of them wanted a chunk, you see. But we had no intent. We wouldn't have bought a union anyway. But I found out what the problem was. First of all, they couldn't have delivered. These five people, I found they didn't have that kind of stroke. Any guys will stand there and say they can buy and sell a group of people aren't very good people, you know. But we found out what it was. Well, I found this kind of thought all over the country. Now, I found some new good ones. We got a few of them came in, but they ultimately joined the OCAW because the other union never got off the ground. We used the same company. Standard Indiana Group at Sugar Creek joined our group. We had a group of Tidewater Group up on the East Coast that joined our group. Beyond New Jersey plant came in. It was a good sized group. We had a couple of terminals up in New England area that came in. But it wasn't any success. And when I considered, at the end of about 5.5 months, I made my report to the president that I thought that it was foolish to waste any more money sending me around to try to accomplish this. That wasn't the way we were going to do it. We would have to, that's what my report said, if we wanted them in our union, we'd have to go out and organize them from the ground up. So that attempt at merger with those groups, it would have been wonderful if it succeeded, but it didn't succeed. We then went into the merger with the gas, coke, and chemical workers. Now, the gas, coke, and chemical workers was a union that was started by the CIO on the East Coast, kind of as a catch-all organization for unorganized groups of any kind that wanted to come into the CIO but didn't have a union that was interested in going after them. So we had a conglomeration of all kinds of groups. Now, some of them were good, substantial groups. We had Squibb in two plants up there. We're in that group. We had some chemical groups. We had some cigar makers, some graveyard, some grave diggers. They had a union of about, they said, 60,000 to 70,000, and with us saying about 80 to 90. Now, these were claims in the sense of the numbers that we'd actually had signed up that we hadn't yet cleared out of the records. So we'll say 90 and 70, 160,000 combined union. We had a convention in 1955 in Cleveland, Ohio, which brought these two unions together into a changed union. We changed the name from Oil Workers International Union and United Gas, Coke, and Chemical Workers to the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, because they had some atomic workers and we had some. When we combined, we were the largest union in representation of atomic workers. We had the most atomic union or worker members. That merger was successful. We put it together. It complicated our internal workings of our union something severely, because we had a union that had been formed by the CIO, where a union was sort of another union, an amalgamation of unions, was sort of the controller of this international union. And although they had a president and a secretary, treasurer, and others, they had been dependent pretty much on CIO help to organize, to grow. And they had never really become economically self-sufficient. They had developed a sort of we thought, top-heavy union in the sense of its administrative personnel. They did some things that we didn't do. They elected directors, so that each director in his own district was elected by the people, and it's pretty hard for a president who is elected, even though he's elected by them all, to tell a man down here who's also elected, you got to do this or so, because he can't unelect him, you know. So they did that. We didn't agree with that theory, rightly or wrongly. So there was a number of internal workings. We, instead of having 7 districts that we had, we now had 16. And all the administrative tasks and things got complicated. In order to put the union together and to make room for everybody, because you can't get anybody to agree to merge if you're going to get their job, we had to make jobs. So they had 3 officers and we had 3. Put them together, you got 6. So we had to make 6 administrative officers' jobs. So we ended up having a president, 4 vice presidents, and a secretary treasurer. 4 vice presidents who are not constitutionally assigned to any specific duties, but I all take the assignment from the president, and that can become quite unwieldy. And of course, it's a lot of people up there close to the throne that like to take their chance of sitting on that seat, and so it created that kind of a problem. Especially when we had, in order to put it together, we took the president, we took the secretary treasurer, the president of the Gas Coke had left, we took the president and the secretary treasurer of the Gas Coke, and they had been one kind of a political team, and we took 2 vice presidents from the Gas Coke, and that was another political team. So we had 4 people from the Gas Coke and Chemical Workers who were opposed, who had always opposed each other, and they still did within the internal workings of the union. Each was trying to eliminate the other 2. And it ended up after about 4 years, I'd say it was in 59 probably, we got, no it wasn't either, it was 60. No, 59 it was, 59. We got to the place where our union at a convention decided that we had to streamline, so we cut back down to 4 officers, president, 2 vice presidents, secretary, treasurer. Now both of the other vice presidents got jobs. They weren't pushed out, but they ended up as at the director's level of the union. And so this was the one of the problems that we had. But that merger was successful. We still have a combined organization and a pretty successful union. We had made another attempt in 1965. Jack Knight determined not to run for president anymore. He was getting old and he was tired, and pressures were getting pretty strong against him. People were beginning to think they could run against him. He had had a little bit of a political scare a couple of years before that, 2 years before that. That's when he decided that he didn't want me as his assistant anymore. As he thought I was involved in an attempt by a very good friend of mine who was the director from Canada who had threatened to run against him as president. He backed out and didn't actually run, but that wasn't my doing either. But I wasn't in support of him. Even though he was my friend, but Jack Knight didn't think so. And he was told by some people who worried about my political influence and wanted me out of the scene. He was told by that group that I was involved, and so he decided he didn't want me in that job anymore, so he sent me back as a rep here in California. About 3 months later, he came out and made a public apology to me because he had done so much wrong, but that... I never really had any real deep-seated bad feelings toward Jack. I did temporarily, but it didn't last long. I mean, I didn't like the fact that he thought I was doing something I didn't do, or that I was capable of being his assistant and working against him, that kind of thing, but I wasn't really upset. I could kind of see some of the reasons why he might think so. And anyway, he decided not to run, and when that job is being vacated, then of course there's all of the political forces of the union, a whole new group of forces come into being. The guy who was our Secretary Treasurer, he'd been appointed to that job when our other secretary died, decided to run for president. Now, he was, if he'd run on his own, he'd have probably not had a lot of opposition, because he was a capable man, but he decided to run with a team, and there were two or three people on that team that some of us just wouldn't have any part of. We didn't want that kind of leadership. So, we had a, when he ran, that was in 1965, he ran against a guy by the name of Bill Forrester, who had been a director first in the New York area and then subsequently down in Houston, and that's better.